Side 6, Winds of Fate by Mercedes Lackey, continuing on page 215. Try something noncommittal. Ask something harmless. Did Quentin say why Adept Jendar is living in life care when the school he founded is all the way back up near Petras in Rethwellen? He asked, trying to sound humble. Don't try to sound humble, Skiff, she replied waspishly. It doesn't suit you. Then she relented and unbent a little. He thought perhaps she turned again to make certain he was still following, and hadn't halted his companion in a fit of pique. Sorry, that wasn't called for. He did tell me some. Jendar wants to be down here in Jakatha, so he's somewhere nearer his Shinnain relatives, but he doesn't want to be in Kata Shinnain because it's really just a trade city, and it practically dries up and blows away in the fall and winter. What did he mean by that? Skiff asked, puzzled. I should think a trade city would have anything he'd want. She paused. Let me see if I can do a good imitation of Quentin imitating Jendar. Her voice shifted to that of a powerful old man's, with none of the querulousness Skiff expected. I want fabulous food, carpets, hot bathhouses, and decent shops, beautiful women to make a fool of me in my old age, servants to pamper me outrageously, and merchants to suck up to me when I'm in the mood to buy something. Skiff chuckled. Elspeth did an excellent imitation when she was in a good mood, and from the sound of it, she had shaken her foul humor. I have the feeling I'm going to like Caro's uncle as much as I do her. I think I'm going to like the old man, she said, echoing his thought. Quentin also said that there were two reasons Jendar didn't retire in Great Harzy, even though the school and the village begged him to. The first was that Great Harzy is a real backwater, too far for a man his age to travel to get to Petras, even if it is less than a day's ride away. The other is that he said that if he stayed, the new head would never be a head. He'd always be consulting with Jendar and never making any decisions for himself. He thought that would be a pretty stupid arrangement. Her voice shifted again. Let the youngster make his own mistakes, the way I did. You certainly haven't been hanging on my coattails, Quentin, and you're doing just fine. She paused again and said, significantly, Jendar obviously believes in letting people grow up. I get the point, Skiff muttered. I get the point. It wasn't far now to the turnoff, but Elspeth was beginning to wonder if she'd make it that far. And she wondered also what happened to a herald who murdered his companion. Once in a while, she wished there was such a thing as repudiation by the herald, and this was one of those times. The summer heat was bad down here. It was worse without trees to give some shade. The Pelagirus forest lay somewhere to their right, but there wasn't a sign of it along this roadway, except for the occasional faint fugitive hint of pine. Well, you're certainly smug today, Elspeth finally said to Gwena when, for the fourth time, a sensation as of someone humming invaded the back of her mind. She pushed her hat up on her forehead and wiped away the sweat that kept trickling into her eyes. What? Gwena replied, her ears flicking backwards. What on earth do you mean? You were humming to yourself, Elspeth told her crossly. If you were human, you'd have been whistling. Tunelessly, might I add? It's damned annoying when someone is humming in your head. It's not something a person can just ignore, you know. I'm just feeling very good, Gwena replied defensively, picking up her pace a little, to the surprise of Simri, who hurried to match her, hooves kicking up little clouds of dust. Is there anything wrong with that? It's a lovely summer day. Oh, really? A candlemark ago you were complaining about the heat. Well, maybe I'm getting used to it. Gwena tossed her head, her mane lashing Elspeth's wrist, and added, Maybe it's you. Maybe you're just being testy. Her mind voice took on a conciliating tone. Is it the wrong moon time, dear? No, it's not, as you very well know. Besides, that has nothing to do with it, Elspeth snapped, without thinking. Skiff is being a pain in the tail. Skiff is falling in love with you, Gwena replied, dropping the conciliating tone. You could do worse. I know he is, and I couldn't do worse, she said, conscious only of her annoyance. I'm not talking about differences in rank or background, either. And don't you start playing matchmaker. He's a very nice young man, and I'm not the least interested in him. All right? All right, all right, Gwynne said, sounding surprised at her vehemence. Forget I said anything. Gwynne closed her mind to her chosen, and Elspeth sighed. It wasn't just Skiff and his problem that was bothering her, or even primarily Skiff. It was something else entirely. It was a feeling, one that had been increasing every step she rode toward Lithecare, the feeling that she was being herded toward something, some destiny, like a complacent cow to the altar of sacrifice, as if she were doing what she should be doing, and she didn't like it. Not one tiny bit. Everything had fallen into place so very neatly, she could almost tally up the events on her fingers. First, Caro showed up, with a magic sword. Then, Elspeth, having seen real magic at work, firsthand, just happened to get the idea that Valdemar needed mages. Then, Caro just happened to back that up, having had to deal with mages herself in her career. All that could have been mere coincidence, but not the rest. Why was it that within a month she was attacked by an assassin who may have been infiltrated into Haven magically? There was a magic attack on a major border post, manned by Caro's people, so an accurate report got back. And the council, for some totally unknown reason, seemed to be forced into letting her go look for mages. And lo, as if in a book, Caro just happened to have kept up contact with her old mage, who happened to have kept up contact with his old teacher, who happened to be Caro's uncle and doubly likely to cooperate. No one had stopped them on this trek. No one had even recognized them as far as Elspeth knew. Everyone was so helpful and friendly, it was sickening. Even the Merc seemed to take her stories at face value. There was no sign of Ankar or his meddling. Everything was ticking along quietly, just like it was supposed to occur. They were barely a candlemark away from the turnoff for Lithecare, and the companions were so smug about something she could taste it. Gwynne was humming again, and suddenly she decided that she had had enough. That is it. She yanked so hard on her reins that Gwynne tripped, went to her knees, and scrambled back up again with a mental yelp. And Simri very nearly ran into her from behind. She turned to look at Skiff. He stared stupidly back at her, as if wondering if she had gone mad. That's it, she said. That is it. I am not playing this game anymore. What? Now Skiff looked at her as if certain she had gone mad. I am being herded to something, and I don't like it, she snapped, as much for Gwynne's ears as his. I did want to do this, and Valdemar certainly needs mages, but I am not going to be guided by an invisible hand, as if I were a character in a badly written book. This is not a foreordained quest. I am not in a prophecy, and I am not playing this game anymore. With that, she dismounted and stalked off the side of the road to a rough clearing. Like seemingly always side clearings in this part of Jakatha, it was a bit of grass, surrounded by fenced fields of grain, with a couple of dusty, tall bushes, and a very small well. She sat down beside the well defiantly and crossed her arms. Skiff dismounted, his expression not the puzzled one she had expected, but something she couldn't read. He walked slowly over to her, the companions following with their reins trailing on the ground. Well, she said, staring up at him. He shrugged, but the conflicting emotions on his face convinced her that he knew something she didn't. I am not moving, she said, firmly, suppressing the urge to cough as road dust went down her throat. I am not moving until you tell me what you know about what's going on. He looked helplessly from side to side, then his companion wickered and looked him in the eyes, nodding, as if to say, you might as well tell her. I thought so. She glared at Gwynne, who flattened her ears. You should have told me in the first place. It was the companions, Skiff said faintly. They sort of ganged up on their heralds when you first wanted to go looking for mages. The heralds that didn't want to let you go, like your mother. Well, they kind of got bullied. They what? She exclaimed, and turned to Gwynne, surprise warring with other emotions she couldn't even name.
It had to be done,
Guenor replied firmly.
You had to go. It was important.
That's not all, Skip said, looking particularly hangdog.
For one thing, they absolutely forbid you to be told what they were doing. For another, they're the ones that suggested Quentin in the first place. They said he was the only way to an important mage that they could trust.
I knew it, she said fiercely. I knew it, I knew it. I knew they were hock deep in whatever was going on. I knew I was being herded like some stupid sheep.
She turned to Skip, ignoring the companions. Did they say anything about the Shinnain? She demanded. If I'm going to do this, I am by damn going to do it my way.
Well, he said slowly. No, not that I know of.
We don't know anything about the Shinnain goddess, Guenna said, alarm evident in her mind voice. She's not something Valdemar has ever dealt with. We're not sure we can trust her.
You can't manipulate her, you mean?
She replied flatly. No, she could be like Iftel's god. She could care only for the welfare of her own people. That's all.
We know some of what she is and does, but it's not something we want to stake the future of Valdemar on.
Gwena's mind voice rose with anxiety. Elspeth cut her off.
What do you have to say about this? She asked Skiff. You, I mean, not the companions.
He flushed and looked horribly uncomfortable.
I don't know really what the companions think of it.
He's lying. His companion is giving him an earful.
But from everything Caro said, the Shinnain probably could give you the teaching, and if they couldn't, they would know someone who could.
He gulped, and wiped sweat from his forehead with his sleeve.
Caro trusts them. Not just her relatives, I mean. And so does her companion. I know that much.
Guenna snorted.
Of course Saevil says she trusts them. Contrary old beast, she'd say that just to be contrary.
Elspeth ignored the waspish comment.
Fine. She turned to stare into Gwena's blue eyes. I am going to Cata Shinnain, and I am going to see if the Shinnain know someone to train me.
She turned the stare into a glare. That is where I am going, and you are not going to stop me. I'll walk if I have to.
I'll buy a plow horse in the next village, but I am not going to live care, and that is my final word on the subject.
She raised her chin and stared defiantly at all of them.
Now, are you with me, or do I go on alone?
Less than a candle mark later, they passed the turnoff to Live Care, heading straight south to Cata Shinnain. And Guenna was giving her the most uncomfortable ride of her life, in revenge. But every bruise was a badge of victory. And I hope I'll still believe that in the morning when I can't move.
Chapter 12. Darkwind. This patrol, like all the others lately, had been completely uneventful.
This is almost too easy, Darkwind thought, making frequent checks of the underbrush beside the path for signs of disturbance. A week now that Nyara's been hiding with us, and there's nothing from the other side, nothing hunting her, except that couple of Wyrsa I caught on her trail. No magic probes, nothing. The very quietude set all his nerves on edge.
Of course, her shielding is really outstanding.
Falconsbane might not know she's here, or even that she headed this way when she ran. He could be hunting for her in another direction altogether.
That was what Treyvan said. Hydona was of the opinion that Falconsbane knew very well she'd come this way, but assumed she was in the Vale.
She pointed out that in all the time Falconsbane had been on their border, and everything Nyara said indicated that he had been there for a very long time. He'd never directly challenged Kashena. He was only one adept, after all, and there were at least 5 adepts and 10 times that many masters in Kashena. And even though none of them were operating at full strength, the mages of Kashena could still be more than he cared to meet in conflict, especially when the conflict was over the relatively minor matter of the loss of a single change child.
He can always make another, Hydona had said callously. It is unusual for one like himself to keep a pet for longer than a few years.
And oddly enough, Nyara agreed with Hydona's analysis. If he was angered at all, his anger would have been for a loss. Not for the loss of me, she'd said, more than a little piqued at having to admit that she was worth so little to her former master. As an individual, I mean very little to him. He has threatened many times to create another, to then see how I fared among his lesser servants as their plaything. All that would goad him into action was that he had lost a possession. If something distracted him from that anger, he would have made only a token attempt to find me, more to appease his pride than to get me back. So it seemed, for other than the pair of Wyrsa, there had been nothing in the way of activity. Not along Darkwind section, nor Dawnfire's, not, for that matter, anyone else's, except for Moon Mist. She ran into a basilisk who decided her little patrol area was a good one to nest in. Prying that thing out had taken 5 scouts and 3 days. They didn't want to kill it if they didn't have to. Basilisks were stupid, incredibly dangerous, and ravenous carnivores who would eat anything that couldn't run away from them. But they weren't evil. They had their place in the scheme of things. They dined with equal indifference on their own kills or carrion. And there were few things other than a basilisk that would scavenge the carcasses of cold drakes or Wyrsa. But no one wanted a basilisk for a near neighbor, not even the most ardent animal lover. Not even Earthsong, who had once unsuccessfully tried to breed a vulture for a bond bird. But that was the only excitement there had been for days, and there was no way that incident could have been related. No one could herd a basilisk. The best you could do was to make things so unpleasant for it that it chose to move elsewhere. No one, in all the history of the Teladrass, had ever been able to even touch what passed for one's mind, much less control it. The history said they were a failed and abandoned experiment, like so many other creatures of the Twisted Lands, a construction of one of the Bloodpath mages at the time of the Mage Wars. But, perversely, once abandoned, the basilisk continued to persist on its own.
It's just a good thing they only lay 2 or 3 fertile eggs in a lifetime, he thought wryly, or we'd be up to our necks in them.
A broken swath of vegetation caught his attention, and he looked closer, only to discover the spoor of a running deer and the tracks of its pursuer, an ordinary enough wolf pair. From the small hooves, it was probably a weanling separated from its mother. It wouldn't have broken down the bushes if it had been an adult.
This is ridiculous, he thought. I might as well be a forester in the cleansed lands. There hasn't been anything worth talking about out here for the past week.
That was the way the area around Avail was supposed to look just before a clan moved to a new spot. No magic-warped creatures like the giant serpent, no mage-made things like the basilisk, just normal animals, relatively normal plant-like.
Maybe Father's been right about sitting and waiting for the Hearthstone to settle.
Up ahead, the forest thinned a little, the sunlight actually reaching the ground in thick shafts. These golden lances penetrated the emerald leaf canopy, bringing life to the forest floor, for the undergrowth was thicker here, and there was even thin grass among the wild plum bushes. He looked up at the hot blue eye of the sky as he reached a patch of clearing, framed by tree branches. Bree soared overhead, calmly.
He hadn't seen anything either. In fact, he'd been so bored, he'd taken a rock dove and eaten it while waiting for Darkwind to catch up.
It had been a long time since he'd been able to hunt and eat while out on scout. Starblade's answer to the fracture of the Heartstone had been to wait and see what would happen. He'd insisted that the great well of power would drain itself, slowly, heal itself, in fact, until it was safe to tap into it, drain the last of its energies, construct a gate, and leave. Darkwind had disagreed with his father on that, as he had, seemingly, on everything else. And up until the past week, it certainly hadn't looked as if the Heartstone was following his father's predictions. In fact, if anything, the opposite was true. There had been more uncanny creatures, more Mistborn attracted, more actually trying to penetrate the borders. And recently there had been the other developments, the fact that the mages within the Vale had been unable to sense the changes in energy flows outside it, the fact that now most of the scouts' bond birds refused to enter the Vale itself, the perturbations that Treyvan sensed. But maybe that was all kind of the last gasp. Maybe things have settled down. Maybe Father's right. But when he considered that possibility, all his instincts revolted.
Yes, but what if I just feel that way? Because if Father is right, it means that I am wrong. What if I am wrong? What does it matter? Other than if I'm wrong, Father will never let me forget it.
He stopped for a moment, hearing a thudding sound, then realized it was only a hare drumming alarm, hind foot beating against the ground to alert the rest of his warren, probably at the sight of Bree. Is it just that I can't admit that sometimes he might be right? On the other hand, there was a feeling deep inside, connected, he now realized, with the mage senses he seldom used, that Starblade was wrong, dead wrong. A heartstone that badly damaged could not heal itself. It could only get worse. And this calm they were experiencing was just a pause before things degenerated to another level.
I guess I'll enjoy it while it lasts and stay out of the Vale as much as possible.
He sent another inquiring thought at Vree, but the gyre had no more to report than the last time. It was very tempting to cut everything short and go see how Nyara was doing. So tempting that he fought against the impulse stubbornly, determined to see his patrol properly done. It might make up for the other days he had neglected it.
Not really neglected it. There were the Dyheli, and then Nyara.
His efforts at appeasing his conscience came to nothing. It still wasn't done, and if I hadn't been very lucky, things could easily have slipped in. He no longer worried that these temptations were caused by anything other than his own selfish desire to spend more time with a changed child. Nyara was good company, in a peculiar way. She was interested in what he had to say, and just as interesting to listen to. At least I can appease my conscience with the fact that I'm learning something about our enemy. She was also as incredibly attractive as she had been the first time he'd seen her. If he had been a less honorable man, her problematic virtue wouldn't have stood a chance, which led him to revise his earlier assumptions, to think that she wasn't in control of that part of herself. She might even be completely unaware of it.
That would fit the profile of her master.
Morna Lifa Falkensbane would not have wanted her in control of anything having to do with sexual attraction. He would have wanted to pull the strings there. Which was one reason why Darkwind had continued to resist letting her lure him to her bed. He had no prejudice against her, but he was not sure what would happen, what little traps had been set up in her makeup, that a sexual encounter would trigger. That would fit Falkensbane's profile, too. Make her a kind of walking, breathing trap that only he could disarm, so anyone meddling with the master's toy would find himself punished by the thing he thought to enjoy. With a set of claws, and sharp-pointed teeth, like she had, he didn't think he was in any hurry to find out if his speculations were true, either. Darkwind was not about to risk laceration, or worse, in a passionate embrace with her. He was so lost in his own thoughts that he almost missed the boundary marker, the blaze that marked the end of his patrol range and the beginning of dawn fires. He glanced at the sun, piercing through the trees, but near the horizon. It was time for Thunder Snow to take over for him, and if he hurried, he would have a chance to chat with Nyara before he went to the council meeting. He was already on the path to the Hirtasi village before the thought was half finished.
I think this is the best chance I'm going to have. Things have been so quiet, they can't blame disturbances on your presence. So I'm going to tell the council about you and put your request to them, he told her as they both soaked up the last of the afternoon's heat on the top of the bluff.
She didn't answer at first, just turned on her back and stretched, lithe and sensuous, and seemed just as innocent of the effect it had on him as a kitten. She wasn't even watching him. She was watching a butterfly a few feet away from them. That didn't stop his loins from tightening, or keep a surge of pure, unmixed lust from washing over him, making it difficult to think clearly for a moment. He sought relief in analyzing the effect. That sexual impact she has can't be under conscious control. She couldn't fake the kind of nonchalance she's got right now. When, she asked, yawning delicately, is it tonight, this meeting? He nodded, He'd explained to her the need to wait until a regular meeting so that her appearance would seem a little more routine. She'd agreed, both to his reasons and to the need to wait. But in fact, his real reasons were just a little different. He put off explaining what had happened in its entirety until he wouldn't have to face his father alone. Starblade in the presence of the rest of the elders was a little easier to deal with than Starblade in the privacy of his own Ecole, where he could rant and shout and ignore anything Darkwind said. And he tended not to take quite so much of his son's hide in public, where there were witnesses both to his behavior and to what Darkwind told him. "It is well," Nyara purred, satisfaction brimming in her tone. She blinked sleepily at Darkwind, her eyes heavy-lidded, the pupils the merest slits. "Though I still cannot travel, should they grant me leave. You will say that, yes?"
"Don't worry," he replied. "I'm going to make that very clear."
In fact, that was one of the points he figured he had in his favor. Nyara obviously could not move far or fast, and he wanted to have a reason for why he had left her with the Hirtasi instead of putting her under a different guardian.
"More competent," Starblade would undoubtedly say. "Less sympathetic," was what he would mean. And if worse came to worst, he wanted to have a reason for continuing to leave her here, instead of putting her with a watcher of Starblade's choice. "You still seem fairly weak to me," he continued, "and Nira's healer seems to think it's a very good idea for you to stay with us until those cracked bones of yours have a chance to heal a bit more."
"And that reminds me, have you had any problems with the Hirtasi?" "Have they complained of me?" she snapped sharply, twisting her head around to cast him a look full of suspicion.
He was taken a little aback. "Why, no, it's just that I wanted to make certain you were getting along all right. If there was any friction, I could move you. Maybe to the ruins where the griffins are. It's pretty quiet there."
"No, no," she interrupted, her voice rising as if she were alarmed. Then, before he could react, she smiled. "Your pardon. I did not mean that the way it may have sounded. Trevan and Hydona are wonderful, and I like them a great deal, as I expected to like anything Mona Lisa hated. I learned early that whatever thwarted him, he hated, and that what he hated, I should be prepared to find good."
"He knows about Trevan and Hydona."
"No, no, no," she interrupted again, hastily. "I am saying things badly today. No, it is only griffins in general that he hates, as he hates Birdkin, so I was prepared to like you."
"He never told me why."
She shrugged indifferently, and by now Darkwind knew he'd get nothing more out of her on the subject. She had all the ability of a ferret to squirm her way out of anything she didn't want to talk about.
"But if she liked them, why wouldn't she want to stay near them?"
"It is the little one," she sighed, pensively, as if answering his unspoken suspicion. "I am very sorry, for I am going to say something that will revolt you, Birdkin. But I cannot bear little ones, no matter the species." She shuddered, giggling in voices to pierce the ears, running about like mad things, shrieking enough to startle the dead. "I cannot bear little ones." She looked him squarely in the eyes. "I have," she announced, "no motherly instinct. I do not want motherly instinct. I do not want to see little ones for more than a short time. At long intervals." He laughed at her long face.
"I can see your point," he replied. "They are a handful.
And soon there will be two more. This time the very little ones, who cry and cry all night, and will not be comforted, who become ill for mysterious reasons, and make messes at both ends." "No," she finished firmly, "I care much for Trevan and Hydona, but I will not abide living with the little ones."
"You've been getting along all right with the Hirtasi, though?"
he asked anxiously. If he had to leave her here for any length of time, it would be a good idea to make sure both parties were willing. Nira had indicated that he had seen no trouble with her, but Darkwind wanted to be sure of that. Sometimes the Hirtasi were a little too polite. "As well as one gets along with one's shadow." She shrugged. They are quiet. They bring me food and drink. They are polite when I speak to them. But mostly they are not there. To speak to, that is. A wry smile touched the corners of her mouth, and the tips of her sharp little canine teeth showed briefly. I am well aware that they watch me, but in their place I would watch me. So all is well. I pretend to ignore the watchers. The watchers pretend they are most busy counting grass stems. We both know it is pretense, and politeness is preserved. Darkwind laughed. She smiled broadly. Now I know why Neera called her a very polite young creature. As long as you're doing all right here. He glanced at the setting sun. I have to get back for that meeting. I expect to have some trouble with it. Nyara's smile faded to a wistful ghost. I wish I could tell you it would be otherwise, but I doubt it will be so. I only hope you do not come to regret being my champion. He sighed and got to his feet. I hope so, too. The windows of the Ekale shook as his father pounded the table with his fist. By all the gods of our fathers, Starblade stormed, I never thought my own son would be so much of a fool. Darkwind stared at a patch of the exposed bark of the parent tree, just past his father's shoulder, and kept his face completely expressionless. At least it sounded like most of the tirade was over. This was mild compared to the insult Starblade had hurled at him at the beginning of the session. Then again, it might simply be that Starblade had run out of insults. Starblade shook his fist in the air, not actually threatening Darkwind, but the implication was there. If I didn't know better, I'd swear I couldn't be your father. I've never... That's enough, Starblade, interrupted old Rainlance tiredly. That is quite enough. The quiet words were so unexpected, especially coming from Rainlance, that both Starblade and his son turned to stare in surprise at the oldest of the four elders. Rainlance never interrupted anyone or raised his voice, except that he had just done both. By now we all know that you think yours, Darkwind, is the greatest fool ever born. We also know precisely why you think that. Rainlance leveled a penetrating gaze at Starblade that froze him where he sat. The fact is, I've known you a great deal longer than Darkwind, and I think there are times when you allow some of your opinions to unbalance your judgment. This is one of them. It just so happens I've never shared your peculiar prejudice against the changed children. I won't go into why right now, but I have several good reasons, strong ones, to disagree with you on that. And I also do not share your view of Darkwind's incompetence. He coughed and shook his head. In point of fact, I think Elder Darkwind has done a fine job up until now. A very fine job. His peers trust him. He has never let his private opinions interfere with his judgment, and I don't see any reason to make a snap decision about this other of his. I don't see any reason, in fact, why we shouldn't continue to help her. Rainlance looked pointedly at the other elder, Ice Shadow, who shrugged, the crystals braided into his hair, tinkling like tiny wind chimes. She's not a danger where she is, Ice Shadow said. She hasn't caused any trouble. That we know of, snapped Starblade. Ice Shadow gave Starblade a look of disapproval, and Darkwind knew he'd scored at least one point. Ice Shadow hated to be interrupted. Very well, if you insist on that phrasing. That we know of. Frankly, I see no harm in letting her stay where she is until she's healthy, and considering her request for safe passage then. Rainlance nodded. Starblade frowned angrily, then pounced. Under strict watch. Darkwind may be a gullible boy being led by a pair of come-hither eyes and a sweet voice, but I'm not so sure this other may not be playing a deeper game. I say she stays under strict watch with careful observers. You can't get more careful than her Tossy, Ice Shadow remarked to the ceiling of his Ekale. And if she's leading Darkwind around by his urges, that ploy won't work on her Tossy.
even stubborn, pig-headed old, mages will admit to that.
It was Eyeshadow's turn to receive a glare, but the elder ignored it, winked broadly at Darkwind when Starblade turned away in disgust.
I think the Hertossi will do as watchers, Rainlance said smoothly, soothingly, as he sought to heal the split in the council. They are certainly quite competent, but I do agree she should be kept as far from the Vale itself as possible.
And if she causes any trouble, if she even looks like she's causing any trouble, Starblade growled.
Rainlance raised his voice a little, and annoyance crept into it.
She'll have to be dealt with. She'll find herself bound and staked, and you can tell her so, Starblade shouted. Are you quite finished?
Rainlance shouted back, his temper frayed to the snapping point.
I'd like to get on with this, if I may.
Starblade sank back into a seat with an inarticulate mumble, confining himself to angry glares at anyone who happened to glance at him. Rainlance closed his eyes for a moment and visibly forced himself to calm down. Darkwind had no sympathy to spare for him. He'd been on the receiving end of his father's tempers too often to feel sorry for anyone else.
Really, Darkwind, Rainlance continued, opening his eyes, his voice oozing reason and conciliation. You must see this in the perspective of the Vale and clan as a whole. We really can't take her into the Vale. We can't take the chance, however slim, that she might be some kind of infiltrator.
I'm not asking for her to be brought into the Vale, Darkwind replied, echoing Rainlance's tone as much as he was able. I'm just asking that she be allowed nearer. Right now she's in jeopardy. She's hurt, and she can't run the way the Hertossi can. I doubt she'd be able to get away if something comes over the border, especially if it's something that's come hunting especially for her. She can't run, she can't hide, and mage gifted or not, she probably can't protect herself from any kind of trained mage.
Eyeshadow shook his head regretfully. Darkwind got the feeling that if this hadn't been so serious an issue, he was so annoyed with Starblade right now that he would have been glad to agree with Darkwind, just for a chance to spite his father.
No, it's just not possible, and I'm sure she realizes that, even if you don't. After all, look at what she is, and what we are. We're enemies, or at least she's been on the enemy's side, and yet she came to us, supposedly for help. She admitted she was going to use us as a kind of stalking horse. No, she stays where she is, and that's the end of it.
Well, said Starblade, his voice penetrating the silence that followed Eyeshadow's speech like a set of sharp talons, his eyes narrowed, and a tight little smile on his lips. Since you seem so worried about her, since you brought her into our boundaries in the first place, and since she is in your territory, I think it's only fair that you be the one to undertake her protection, even if it means you have to fall back on Majory.
He looked around at the other elders.
Isn't that fair?
I don't know, Rainlance began.
I'd say it is, Eyeshadow said firmly. I've never been happy that when Songwind left us, his magic did as well, Darkwind. I understand your feelings, but I've never been happy about it. You could be quite a mage if you'd give it another try.
Rainlance shrugged. Starblade cast his son a look of triumph.
It seems there's a consensus, he said smugly.
Darkwind managed not to jump up and hit him, scream at the top of his lungs, or do anything else equally stupid and adolescent. In fact, his reaction, so completely under control, seemed to disappoint his father. He thought quickly and realized that, unwittingly, his father had not only left him an out, he'd given the scout a chance to do something he'd been campaigning for all along. He'd have to phrase this very carefully. Very well, elders, he replied, nodding to each of them in turn. I am overruled. Nyara may stay, under the eyes of the Hertossi. I will undertake to keep the changed child protected, using all the resources at my disposal.
Is that your will?
Rainlance nodded. That's fine, Eyeshadow said. Starblade looked suspicious, but finally gave his consent.
"Done," said Rainlance. "You have the Council's permission, as stated."
"Good," Darkwind said. "Then, if that is the consensus, I will have the other scouts keep an eye out for her and stand by for trouble. I will recruit whatever Dyheli I can find to stand guard, and I have no doubt there will be plenty of volunteers, since she helped save one of their herds. I will ask Dawnfire to look for help among the Tervardi, and I will see if the Griffins are willing to work some of their protective magics."
He managed not to grin at Starblade's expression.
For once, he'd managed to outmaneuver his father.
But there was no feeling of triumph as he left the meeting. The fight had been too hard for that. Instead, he was weary and emotionally bruised. "Like someone's been beating me with wild plum branches."
He climbed down out of the Ecole before anyone else. It would have been a courtesy to wait for the eldest to descend first, but he wasn't feeling particularly courteous right now, and he really didn't want to chance his father ambushing him for a little more emotional abuse. It was dark enough around here that he should be able to escape, provided he did the unexpected, and he was getting rather good at doing that. So he hurried off into the cover of the thick undergrowth, taking exactly the wrong path, one leading to the waterfall at the head of the vale, instead of the exit. It passed the Heartstone, though not near enough to see the damaged pillar of stone, its cracked and crazed exterior only hinting at the damage echoed across the five plains, and visible to anyone with even a hint of mage sight. He felt it, though, as he passed, an ache like a bruised bone, a sense of impending illness, a disharmony. If he'd had any doubts about it healing itself earlier, they were dispelled now. It hadn't healed itself. It had only gotten worse. Now it left a kind of bitter, lingering aftertaste in the back of his mind. If it had been a berry he'd tasted, he would have labeled it poisonous without hesitation. So he did something he had never thought he would do in his lifetime. He shielded himself against it. The air immediately seemed cleaner, and the sour sense of sickness left him. There was only the hint of incense-like smoke from the memorial brazier at its foot, the flame that commemorated the lives lost when the Heartstone fractured. Now all he had to contend with was the bad taste the meeting had left in his mouth. He started to look for a way to double back to the path he wanted to take, when he remembered that there was another hot spring at the foot of the waterfall. It wasn't a big waterfall, but it was a very attractive one. It had been sculpted by Ice Shadow himself, back when the Vale had first been constructed, and the cool water of a tiny stream fell into a series of shallow rock basins to end in a hot pool of the spring below. Each of the basins had been tuned, although Darkwind had no idea how something like that was done. The music of the falls was incredibly soothing. "Just what I need right now." That decided him. Instead of retracing his steps, he took the path all the way to the end. And as if to confirm that he had made the right decision, as he entered the clearing containing the pool, the moon rose above the tree level, touching the waterfall, and turning it into a shower of flowing silver and diamond droplets. If you didn't know better, you'd swear there was nothing wrong here in the Vale. It's that peaceful. And no one. Absolutely no one was there. Of course, that might have been because this particular pool had once been a popular trysting spot, and there was not a great deal of romance going on in the Vale anymore. Most of the young Taladraths were scouts, and they seldom came this far in now. As for the rest, Darkwind suspected the mages were suffering, perhaps without realizing it, from the same sickened feeling the Heartstone induced in him. That was not the sort of sensation likely to make anyone think of lovemaking. He wondered how many of them had thought to cut themselves off from the stone. Not many, he decided, shedding his clothes and leaving them in a heap beside the pool. It's their power, their lifeblood. They'd rather feel ill than lose their connection to it. They wouldn't be able to draw on it if they shielded themselves against it. Idiots! Then he left all thought of them behind as he plunged in a long, flat dive into the hot water of the pool. He came to the surface and floated on his back,
letting it soothe the aches in his muscles as it forced him into a state of relaxation. Only then did he realize how tightly he had been holding himself and how many of those aches were due to tension. He drifted for a while, losing himself deliberately in the sound of the falling water, the changing patterns of the sparkling droplets, the silence. "Turning merman?" said a shadow at the entrance. He swam lazily to the edge, rested his arms on the sculpted rim, and looked up into Dawnfire's amused eyes. She looked down on him, a faint smile playing on her lips, her hair loose, her boots in her hand.
"Not that I'm aware of," he said lightly. "Unless you saw something I didn't know about."
"Probably not." She knelt down beside him, put her boots down beside her, then unexpectedly seized his head in both her hands, leaned down to water level, and presented him with the most enthusiastic and expert kiss he'd ever had from her. His mouth opened under her questing tongue, and he clutched the rim with both hands, convulsively.
"What? She never gets aggressive."
He became aware that not all the heat coursing through his veins was due to the temperature of the water. He closed his eyes, went passive, and let her lips and tongue play with his until he was breathless. Her hair fell around him, enveloping him in her own silken waterfall. She released him, and he nearly slid under. "That was for going back and saving my Diheli," she said, sitting back on her heels, balancing there as if she had no weight at all.
"I didn't. Exactly."
He regretted having to confess that he had very little to do with it, if that was what she had in mind for a reward. She dismissed everything he was going to say with a wave of her hand. "I know. There's that change child involved in it, and it did the magic. But you stayed with them, and you mind-called them. They'd never have found their way out without that."
"It did the magic. She doesn't know Nyara is female."
His attention was captured and held as she began removing her clothing in the most provocative way, slowly, teasingly. He found himself watching her with parted lips. First the tunic, lacings loosened, then pulling the garment slowly over her head. Then the breeches, inching them down over her hips, sliding them a little at a time down her long, lithe legs. All the while maneuvering so that the shirt covered all the strategically important parts of her. Then the shirt followed the tunic at the same tantalizingly slow speed. At that moment she seemed just as exotic as Nyara, and just as desirable.
"Nyara. If she doesn't know Nyara's a female, there's no harm in not telling her."
She was down to a short chemise now, and she winked once, then vanished into the shadows, reappearing before he had time to think why she had left. "I put the in-use marker at the entrance," she said. "Not that there's anyone likely to be here tonight. I knew you were at the meeting, and I waited to catch you to thank you properly. But you didn't go the way I thought you would. I had to chase you, Lover Hawk." She stood in an unconscious pose at the rim, moonlight softening the hard muscles, and turning her into something as soft and quicksilver as a changed child.
"I wanted to avoid Father," he said, filling his eyes with her.
"I thought so," she said, and laughed. "I figured, knowing you, that as long as you were here, you'd probably decide to soak him out of your thoughts. I've been checking every pool between here and Rainland," says Ecole.
"I'm glad you found me," he said softly.
She sat on the rim, slid out of the chemise and into his arms.
"So am I,"
she whispered, and buried her hands in his damp hair, her lips and tongue devouring him, teasing him, doing things no woman had ever done to him before. His hands slid down her back to cup her buttocks and hold her against him. She strained into the embrace as if she wanted to reach past his skin, to merge with him. Her kiss took on a fiercer quality, and she worked her mouth around to his neck, biting him softly just beneath his ear, while he ran his hands over every inch of her, re-exploring what had become new again, and making her shiver despite the heat of the pool. He gasped as she nuzzled the soft skin behind his ear, then worked her way back to the hollow of his throat, and gasped again when she untangled her fingers from his hair and slid them down his chest,
slowly, teasingly. "Not in here," he managed to whisper, as he grew a little light-headed from the combined heat of the water and his blood. She laughed, low and throatily. "All right." She began to back up, one tiny step at a time, rewarding him for following her with her clever fingers, which were now hard at work well below the waterline, and threatening to make his knees go to jelly at any moment. They reached the edge of the pool, right beside the waterfall, where some kind soul had left a pile of waterproof cushions and mats. She turned away from him to hoist herself up on the rim. He caught her by the waist, lifted her up, and held her there, nibbling his way up the inside of her thighs. And it was her turn to gasp. She buried her hands in his wet hair, and her fingers flexed in time with her breathing. Then she clutched two fistfuls of hair, pulled him away, and swore at him, half laughing. "Get up here, you oaf," she hissed, "or I'll get back in the water and do the same to you. You just might drown." "We can't have that," he chuckled, and joined her, tumbling her into the cushions, nibbling and touching, making her squeal with laughter and surprise. He only had the upper hand for a moment. Then she somehow squirmed out from beneath him and pulled a wrestler's trick on him. Then she had him on his back, bestriding him, a wicked smile on her face as she lowered herself down, a teasing hair's breadth at a time. He arched to meet her, his hands full of her breath, catching her unawares. She cried out and arched her back, driving herself down onto him. Their minds met as their bodies met, and the shared pleasures enhanced their own, as she felt his passion and he experienced every touch of his fingers on her flesh. She roused him almost to a climax, again and again, building the passion higher and higher until he thought he would not be able to bear another heartbeat. Then she loosed the jesses, and they soared together. "Dear gods," he whispered, as they lay together in a trembling symmetry of arms and legs. She giggled. "The reward of virtue." "I think I shall strive to be virtuous," he mumbled. Then exhaustion took him down into sleep before he could hear her reply. If she even made one. Verbally. When he woke, she had moved away from him to lie in a careless sprawl an arm's length away. He'd expected as much. He'd learned over the past few months that she was a restless sleeper, after more than once finding himself crowded onto a tiny sliver of sleeping pad. The moon was just retreating behind the rock of the waterfall. He slipped into the pool for a moment to rinse himself off after his exertions, warm up his muscles, and to cross to the other side without rustling the undergrowth. That would surely wake her, as the sound of someone swimming would not. On the other side of the pool, he used his shirt to dry himself and pulled on the rest of his clothing. He hated to leave her like that. But she is as curious as two cats, and I am not certain I want to answer all the questions she is likely to have when she wakes. She would ask about the rescue, and she would also want to know about the changed child, and when she found out that Nayara was female. "I am not ready to fend off fits of jealousy," he thought wearily. "Father's accusations are bad enough. Hers would be worse, and there is no reason for them." Yet, not that he hadn't entertained a fantasy or two, but they are only fantasies and will remain so, he told his conscience firmly. "Still, they are things I would rather she did not know about. She is not old enough to accept them calmly, for the simple daydreams that they are. However satisfying. Or accept that sometimes the fantasy can be as fulfilling as the reality." He moved quickly and quietly along the paths of the Vale, pausing now and then to take his bearings. Once outside, he went on alert. Although this was where the scouts had their echolays, they did not equip them with retractable ladders for nothing. But the night lay over the forest as quietly as a blanket on a sleeping babe. Only twice did he pause at an unusual sight or sound. The first time, it was a pair of bond birds, huge, snow-winged owls, chasing each other playfully. He recognized them as Katathi and Corwith, and relaxed a little. If they were up, it meant the trail was under watch. The second time he stopped was to hail his older half-brother, Wintermoon,
the bondmaid of those owls, who knelt beside the trail, dressing out a young buck deer. Winter Moon, one of two children of Starblade's contracted liaison with a mage of Katreva, had none of either parent's mage talents, and only enough of mind magic to enable him to speak with his bond bird. The other child, a girl, had apparently inherited it all, but she was with Katreva and out of Starblade's reach. The adept had never forgiven his eldest son for his lack of magery, and Wintermoon had responded by putting as much distance between himself and his father as Clan and Vale would permit. He had no wish to leave Kushena. He had an amazing number of friends and lovers for so taciturn and elusive an individual. It was simply that he also had no wish to deal with a father who had nothing but scorn for him.
"Good hunting," Darkwin said with admiration, eyeing the size of the buck's rack. "Wish I could do that well in the daylight."
He had no fear that Wintermoon had taken anything other than a bachelor. His brother was too wise in a stewardship of the forest to make a stupid mistake in his choice of prey. Wintermoon laughed. Part of his attempt to put distance between himself and Starblade had been to bond exclusively to owls. He had become completely nocturnal, and was one of the night hunters and night scouts, and encountered his father perhaps twice in a moon, if that often.
"It becomes easier as time goes on, and Katathi there lends me his eyes. That's most of it." "How does..."
Darkwind began, puzzled. Wintermoon followed the thought with quicksilver logic.
"He perches above my head. I simply have to adjust my aim to match. Practice enough against trees, and it's not so bad. So, little brother, do you want any of this?"
Darkwind shook his head. "No, I'm fine for the next few days. Dawnfire could use some, though. She was telling me her larder was a little bare. That should make up for my leaving her like that."
"I'll see she gets it. All's clear the way back to your place. Fair skies."
That was a clear dismissal, and really about as social as Wintermoon ever got outside the walls of his Ecolade. "Wind to thy wings," Darkwind responded, and continued up the trail. He didn't entirely release his hold on caution, but he did relax it a little. Wintermoon was completely reliable. If he said it was clear, he didn't mean just the trail. He meant 4 furlongs on either side. Once at his Ecolay, he woke Vree up to let down the ladder strap for him. There was still enough moon for the gyre to see, though he complained every heartbeat and went back to sleep immediately, without waiting for Darkwind to climb up. Even though he was relaxed and utterly weary, he couldn't help thinking about Nyara as he drifted off to sleep. He found himself thinking of her suspiciously, the way his father would. Or Wintermoon, for that matter. He's more like father than he knows, or will admit. He wished he'd been able to persuade the elders to allow her closer, and not just for her protection. No, it would have been much easier to keep a watchful eye on her if she'd been, say, in one of the dead scouts' abandoned Ecolades. Of course, Starblade would have opposed that out of its sheer symbolism. Still, she was within reach. The Hurtasi were clever and conscientious. There were the Griffins, 3 or 4 Tervardi, several Diheli herds, and Dawnfire between here and the Vale, and her only other escape routes lay across the border, into the Outlands.
"I can't see her going back that way," he yawned, finally giving in to sleep. "She was running away. Why in the name of the gods would she ever run back?"
Chapter 13 Interlude. Nyara huddled before her father, abject terror warring with another emotion entirely. Pure, wanton desire. She hated it, that need, that fire that drove her to want him, and even as she hated him, she hated herself for feeling it. Even though she could not control that need, even though she knew it was built into her, as he had sculpted her flesh to suit him, he had also sculpted her mind and her deepest instincts. It didn't matter. None of it mattered. Half the time she suspected he had inserted that same self-hatred into her, purely for amusement. And when he had called her this night, she had obeyed the call. That was built into her, too, for all that she had run away from him, for all that she had deluded herself, telling herself that she could, would resist him,
She could not and had not, and now she groveled here at his feet, longing for his touch, hating and fearing it, despising herself for thinking that she could escape him so easily. It had been no trouble to deceive the little Hertasi who guarded her. They were not creatures of the night, and a simple illusion of her slumbering form in the darkness of the little cave they had given her was enough to satisfy them. She had not lied. Until tonight she had thought she could escape his reach. She had not purposefully misled the Hertasi healer, either. Her weakness and pain were not feigned, nor were her injuries. But what the healer did not know was the extent to which she could ignore pain and fight past weakness when she had to. That was how she had found the strength to counter her father's magic and free the Daiheli herd. That was how he had forced her to come to him when he called, overriding the pain with his own commands. And as usual, he said nothing at first, merely smiled and waited until she had abased herself sufficiently to drive home how helpless she was, how much of her life lay within his power. If she resembled a cat, Mornalitha Falconsbane was a feline, one that stood upon two legs and walked and talked. But there his connection with humanity ended. Long silky hair poured uncut down his back, the color a tawny gold that he maintained magically, else he would have been as bleached silver as any tailor-dress adept. Long silky hair grew on most of his face, carefully groomed and tended by a maid-servant, whose only role was to brush her master whenever he called. His slit-pupiled eyes were a golden green, like watery barrels, his canine sharper and more pronounced than hers. His pointed ears were tufted at the tips, and the silky hair continued down his spine in a luxurious crest, ending at the clefts of the buttocks. For the rest, he was as perfectly formed and conditioned as a human could be, with a body any sculptor would have wept to see. As Nyala knew, intimately. Since he had emerged from his stronghold to call her to the border of Kashena and the beginnings of his domain, he had chosen to dress for the occasion in soft buckskin leather that perfectly matched his hair. Darkwin's disparaging comments to the contrary, Mornalitha seldom wore elaborate costumes. In fact, within his own quarters, he went nude as often as not. Which Nyara also knew, intimately. She knelt before him until her legs ached from the stones and bits of branch beneath them, which he would not permit her to clear away. He lounged on a blanket of fur spread over a fallen tree trunk by a servant, making him an impromptu throne. The golden mage light above his head glistened on his hair, the tips of the fur and on the bat wings of his two giant guardian beasts, half wolf, half something she could not even name, creatures whose heads loomed even with his when he stood. Some of her scars had come from the teeth of those beasts, lessenings in her proper place in the scheme of things, and the proper demeanor to display. Thus she had learned not to move until told, or speak until spoken to. "Well," he said at last, his voice deep, calm, smooth, and soothing. There was a wealth of warm amusement in his voice, which meant he was pleased. She soon discovered why. "You took my invitation to flee to the bird fools as if you had thought of it yourself, dear daughter," he chuckled. "I am proud of you." She burned with humiliation, so it had all been his idea, from the inattentive guards to the captive Daiheli herd. Without a doubt, he had planned everything, knowing how she would react to anything he presented in her path. She should have known. "You followed my plan to the letter, my child," he said with approval. "I am very pleased with you. I assume that they invoked a truth spell upon you." "Of a kind," she whispered, shivering with shamed pleasure as his approval warmed and excited her. "The birdkin do not trust me yet. They keep me in a dwelling of sorts at the border, with Hertasi and one birdkin scout to watch."
"One scout only?"
Mornalitha threw back his head and laughed, and the guardian beasts hung out their tongues in frightening parodies of a canine grin. "They trust you more than you think, little daughter, if they set only one to watch you. Are there no other watchers on you?" She could not help herself. She was compelled to answer truthfully. But she could make him force it out of her, a word at a time, and perhaps he would grow tired before he learned all the truth. Let him think it was fear that tied her tongue.
Two,
she whispered.
Her Tossie?
She shook her head. He frowned, and she trembled.
Tervardi, then?
She shook her head again, hope growing thin that he would lose interest.
Surely not Dyheli.
No. His frown deepened, and she lost any hope of hiding her friend's identities.
What are they?
Speak. He reached out a tendril of power to curl about her. A hand of pain tightened around her mind, though not so much that she could not speak. Her body convulsed.
Griffins,
she whimpered, through tears of agony and anger.
Griffins!
The pain ceased, and she slumped over her knees, head hanging, hands clasped together tightly. She fought to control her tears, so that he would not know how she had come to like the pair, and so have yet another weapon to hold over her.
Griffins.
His voice deepened, and the guardian beasts growled.
Griffins, here. This requires thought. I will have more of these griffins out of you, my child.
But later. She looked up, cheeks still wet with tears. He was looking past her, into the dark forest, his mind elsewhere than on her. Then he took visible hold of himself and gazed down on her, smiling when he saw her tears. He leaned down and lifted a single drop on a long, talon-tipped finger and licked it off, slowly, with sensuous enjoyment. His eyes narrowed as he watched her closely. She shook with a desire she could not control, and that only he could command. He smiled with satisfaction.
This bird fool, he said, leaning back into his fur. His name?
Darkwind, she told him. His eyes lit up from within, and again he laughed, long and heartily, and this time the beasts laughed with him in gravelly growls.
Darkwind? The son of my dear friend, Starblade.
What a delicious irony. Has Starblade seen you, my dearest? She shook her head, baffled by his words. What a pity. He'd have been certain to recognize you, as you would recognize him if you saw him. He laughed again, and she dared a question. I have seen him, this Starblade?
Of course you have, my precious pet. He was my guest here for many days.
Mornalitha's smile deepened, and he licked his lips.
Many, many days. You dined upon his pet bird, do you not recall? And I gave him the crow to replace it, once he learned his place beneath me.
Nyara's eyes widened, as she remembered the Taladras Mornalitha had captured and broken. How she had been so jealous of the new captive who had taken her place, however briefly, in Mornalitha's attentions. How she had so amused Mornalitha with her jealousy that he had chained her in a corner of his bedroom, like a pet dog, so that she was forced to watch him break the new captive to his will. And he, the former captive, without a doubt, would remember her. My little love, if you can contrive a way for Starblade to see you, I should very much be pleased. Mornalitha said caressingly. It would enlarge my vengeance so well to know that he knew that I had an agent in place on his ground, subverting his beloved son. It would be delicious to know how his mind must burn, and yet he could do and say nothing about it. I do not think I can manage that, she told him timidly. He never leaves the veil, and I may not go within it.
Ah, well. Mornalitha said, waving the idea aside. If you can, it would be well. But if not, I am not going to contrive it at the moment.
His expression grew abstracted for a moment. She ventured another question. Is there something that I should know, my lord? He looked down at her and smiled, shaking his head. It is no matter. There are other matters requiring my attention just now, a bit weightier than this. My vengeance has waited long, and it can wait a little longer. She sighed with relief, thinking that he was finished with her, that he had forgotten about Treyvan and Hydona, only to have her hopes crushed. "The griffins," he said, suddenly looking down at her again and piercing her with his eyes. "Tell me about the griffins. Everything." Compelled by his will, she found herself reciting all that she knew about them in a lifeless, expressionless voice. Their names, the names of their two fledglings, what they looked like, where they nested, why they had chosen to nest there, and that there was going to be another mating flight shortly. He sat straight up at that, and she huddled in on herself, shivering, her teeth chattering, free from his compulsion and sick inside with her own treachery. She looked up at him from under her lashes. His eyes were blank, his thoughts turned entirely within. Even his guardian beasts were quiet, holding their breath, not wanting to chance disturbing him. Then he stared down at her and pointed his finger at her, demandingly, the talon fully extended. "More!" he barked, his words and will lashing her like barbed whips. "Tell me more!" But she had nothing more to tell him, and so he punished her, lashing her with his mind, inflicting pain that would leave no outward signs, nor anything that a healer could read, but whose effects would linger for days. And the more he hurt her, the more she yearned for him, burned for him, until the pain and desire mingled and became one obscene whole. She groveled and wept, and did not know whether she wept because of her shame or because of her need. Finally he released her, and she lay where he left her, panting and spent, but still afire with longing for him. "Enough," he said, mildly, softly. "You will learn more. I will call you again when my other business has been attended to, and you will tell me what you have learned. You will try to ensnare Darkwing if you can, but you will learn more of the griffins." "Yes," she whispered. "You will return here to me when I call you." "Yes," she sobbed. "You will remember that my reach is long. I can punish you, even in the heart of the Cushaina Vale, if I choose. Starblade has put my stamp on their hearthstone, and I can reach within at my will." His eyes glittered, and he licked his lips, slowly, deliberately.
"Yes."
"Do not think to truly escape me. I created you, flesh of my flesh, my dearest daughter, and I can destroy you as easily as I created you." He reached down and ran a talon along her chin, lifting her eyes to meet his, and in spite of herself, she thrilled to his touch. She said nothing. She only looked helplessly into his eyes, his glittering, cold, cruel eyes. "Should you try to hide? Should you reach Cushaina Vale, I will call you even from there. And when you come to me, you will find that what you have enjoyed at my hands will be paradise, compared to what I deal you then." He held her in the ice of his gaze. "You do understand, don't you, my dear daughter?" She wept, silent tears running down her cheeks, and making the mage light above his head waver and dance. But she answered him. Oh, yes, she answered him. "Yes, father." "And what else?" he asked, as he always asked. "What does my daughter have to tell her doting father?" And she answered, as she always answered,
I love you, father.
I love you, father. I love and serve only you." And her tears poured down her cheeks as she repeated it until he was satisfied. Chapter 14. Elspeth. Cadashina Inn was a city of tents. At least, that was the way it looked to Elspeth as she and Skiff approached it. They had watched it grow in the distance, and she had wondered at first what it was that was so very odd about it. It looked wrong, somehow, as if something about it was so wildly different from any other city she had ever seen, that her mind would not accept it. Then she realized what it was that bothered her. The colors. The city was nothing but a mass of tiny, brightly colored dots. She could not imagine what could be causing that effect. Was every roof in the city painted a different color? And why would anyone do something as odd as that? Why paint roofs at all? What was the point? As they neared, the dots resolved themselves into flat, conical shapes, which again seemed very strange.
brightly colored, conical roofs? What kind of odd building would have a conical roof? Then she realized they weren't buildings at all. Those were tents she was looking at. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of tents. Now she understood why Quentin had said that Katashina Inn dried up and blew away in the winter. Somewhere amidst all that colored canvas, there must be a core city, with solid buildings and presumably inns and caravanseries. But most of the city was made up of the tents of merchants, and when trading season was over, the merchants departed, leaving behind nothing at all. She glanced over at Skiff, who was eyeing the city with a frown. "What's the matter?" she asked. "Just how are we ever going to find the Talisedron in there?" he grumbled. "Look at that. There's no kind of organization at all." "That we can see," she interrupted. "Believe me, there's organization in there, and once we find an inn, we'll find someone to explain it to us. If there wasn't any way of organizing things, no one would ever get any business done. They'd be spending all their time running around trying to find each other. And when, in your entire life, have you ever known a successful, disorganized trader?" His frown faded. "You have a point," he admitted. "I don't like this," complained Gwena. "I am perfectly well aware that you don't like this," Elspeth replied crisply. "I think this is a mistake, a major mistake. It's still not too late to turn back." Elspeth did not reply, prompting Gwena to continue. "If you turned around now, we could be in life care in..." Elspeth's patience finally snapped, and so did the temper she had been holding carefully in check. "Damn it! I told you I won't be herded into doing something like I was the god's own sheep! I don't believe in fate or destiny, and I'm not going to let you lot move me around your own private chessboard. I will do this my way, or I won't do it at all, and you and everyone else can just find yourself another questing hero. Do you understand me?" Her only answer was a deep, throaty chuckle, and that was absolutely the final insult. She was perfectly ready to jump out of the saddle and walk to Katashina Inn at that point. "And don't laugh at me," she snarled, biting off each mental word and framing them as single words instead of an entire thought so that her anger and her meaning couldn't possibly be misunderstood. Absolute mental silence. Then Gwena replied, timidly, as Elspeth had never heard her speak in her life with her companion. "But I wasn't laughing." Her temper cooled immediately. She blinked. It hadn't really sounded like Gwena, and she'd never known a companion to lie, so if it wasn't Gwena... "Who was it?" she asked. "If it wasn't you, who was it?"
"I..."
Gwena replied hesitatingly, lagging back a little as Skiff rode on ahead, blithely oblivious to what was going on behind him.
"I don't know."
A chill crept down Elspeth's spine. She and Gwena immediately snapped up their defensive shields, and from behind their protection, she searched all around her for someone who could have been eavesdropping on them. It wasn't Skip, that much she knew for certain. The mind voice had a feminine quality to it that could not have been counterfeited. And it wasn't Simri, Skip's companion. Other companions had only spoken to her once, the night of Talia's rescue. She could not believe that if any of them did so again, that it would be for something so petty as to laugh at her. That was as unlikely as a companion lying. And besides, if it had been Simri, Gwena would have recognized her mind voice and said something. Katashina Inn stood on relatively treeless ground, in the midst of rolling plains. While there were others within mind-hearing distance, there were caravans both in front of and behind them. There was no one near. Certainly not near enough to have provoked the feeling of intimacy that chuckle had. In fact, it was incredibly quiet, except for the little buzz of ordinary folks' thoughts, like the drone of insects in a field. The chill spread from her spine to the pit of her stomach, and she involuntarily clutched her hand on the hilt of her sword. "You," said a slow, sleepy mind voice, gravelly and dusty with disuse, as she and Gwena froze in their place.
"Child, you are very like my little student, Ileana, long ago.
so very, very long ago.
And as the last word died in her mind, Elspeth gulped. Her mind churned with a chaotic mix of disbelief, astonishment, awe, and a little fear. It had been the sword that had spoken. Skiff looked back over his shoulder. "Hey," he shouted, "aren't you coming? You're the one who wanted to go here in the first place." But something about their pose or their expressions caught his attention, and Thimry trotted back toward them. As he neared them, his eyebrows rose in alarm. "What's wrong?" he asked urgently. Then, when Elspeth didn't immediately reply, he brought Thimry in knee-to-knee with her, and reaching out, took her shoulders to shake her. "Come on, snap out of it. What's wrong?"
"Elspeth!"
She shook her head and pushed him away.
"God!"
she gulped, her thoughts coming slowly, as if she was thinking through mud.
"Dear God! Skiff! The sword!"
"Caro's sword," he said,
looking into her eyes as if he expected to find signs that she had been mind-blasted.
"What about it?"
"It talked to me. Us, I mean. Gwena heard it, too."
He stopped peering at her and simply looked at her, mouth agape.
"No,"
he managed.
"Yes, Gwena heard it, too."
Her companion snorted and nodded so hard her hackamore jangled.
"A sword?"
He laughed, but it was nervous,
very nervous. "Swords don't talk, except in tales."
"But I am a sword, from a tale, boy."
The mind boy still had the quality of humor, a rich but dry and mordant sense of humor.
"And horses don't talk, except in tales, either."
Skiff sat in his saddle like a bag of potatoes, his mouth still gaping, his eyes big and round. If Elspeth hadn't felt the same way, she'd have laughed at his expression. He looked as if someone had hit him in the back of the head with a board. His mouth worked furiously without anything coming out of it. Finally,
"It talks!"
he yelped.
"Of course I talk."
It was getting better at mind speech by the moment, presumably improving with practice.
"I am as human as you are. Or I was. Once."
"You were?"
Elspeth whispered.
"When? How did you end up like that? And why?"
"A long story,"
the sword replied.
"And one that can wait a little longer. Get your priorities, child. Get in there. Get shelter. Get a place to sit for a while. Then we'll talk. And not before."
And not one more word could any of them get from it, although the companions coaxed and cajoled along with the two heralds. And so, with all of them wondering if they'd gone quite mad, they entered the trade city of Katashinane. The inn was an old one. Deep paths had been worn into the stone floors and the courtyard paving, and the walls had been coated so many times with whitewash that it was no longer possible to tell whether they had been plaster, brick, or stone. The innkeeper was a weary, incurious little old man who looked old enough to have been the same age as his inn. The stone floors and the bathhouse indicated that the place had once catered to prosperous merchants, but that was no longer the case. Now it played host to a variety of mercenaries and the more modest traders who would form caravans together or take their chances with themselves, their own steel, and a couple of pack animals. Their room was of a piece with the inn. Worn floor, faded hangings at the window, simple pallet on a wooden frame for a bed, a table, and no other amenities. The room itself gave ample evidence by its narrowness of having been partitioned off of a much larger chamber. At least it was clean. Elspeth took Need from her sheath, laid the sword reverently on the bed, and sat down beside it, carefully, at the foot. Skiff took a similar seat at the head. The companions, though currently ensconced in the inn stable, were present in the back of their minds. "So now is the time to find out if I'm having a crazy weed nightmare." "All right," she said, feeling a little foolish to be addressing an apparently inanimate object. "We've gotten a room at the inn. The door's locked. Are you still in there?"
"Of course I'm in here,"
replied the sword acerbically. Both she and Skiff jumped.
"Where else would I be?"
Elspeth recovered first and produced a wary smile.
A good question, I guess. Well, are you going to talk to us?
I'm talking, aren't I?
What do you want to know? Her mind was a blank, and she cast an imploring look at Skiff.
What your name is, for one, Skiff said. I mean, we can't keep calling you Sword, and Hey You seems kind of disrespectful.
My holiest stars, a respectful young man! The Sword chuckled, though there was a sense of slight annoyance that it had been the male of the two who addressed her. What a wonder! Perhaps I have lived to see the end of all things.
I don't think so, Skiff replied hesitantly. But you still haven't told us your name.
Trust a man to want that.
There
was a long pause, during which they looked at each other and wondered if something was wrong.
Do you know? I've forgotten it.
How odd. How very odd. I didn't think that would happen.
Another pause, this time a patently embarrassed one.
Well, if that doesn't sound like senility, forgetting your own name.
I suppose you'd just better keep calling me Need.
It's been my name longer than the one I was born with anyway.
Skip looked at Elspeth, who shrugged.
All right. Need, if that doesn't bother you. When you get to be my age, very little bothers you.
Another dry mental chuckle.
When you're practically indestructible, even less bothers you. There are advantages to being incarnated in a sword.
Elspeth saw the opportunity and pounced on it. How did you get in there anyway? You said you used to be human.
It's easier to show you than tell you,
the blade replied.
That's why I wanted you locked away from trouble and sitting down.
End of Side 6. Side 7. Winds of Fate by Mercedes Lackey. Continuing on page 258. Abruptly, they were no longer in a shabby old room in an inn that was long past being first quality. They were somewhere else entirely. A forge. Elspeth knew enough to recognize one for what it was. Brick-walled, dirt-floored. She seemed to be inside someone else's head, a passive passenger, unable to do more than observe. She rubbed the sword with an oiled piece of goat skin and slid it into the wood and leather sheath with a feeling of pleasure. Then she laid it with the other 11 blades in a leather pack. 3 swords for each season, each with the appropriate spells beaten and forged into them. A good year's work, and one that would bring profit to the sisterhood. Tomorrow she would take them to the autumn harvest fair and return with beasts and provision. Her swords always brought high prices at the fair, though not as high as they would be sold for elsewhere. Merchants would buy them and carry them to select purchasers, in duchies and baronies and provinces that had nothing like the sisterhood of spell and sword. But before they were sold again, they would be ornamented by jewelers, with fine scabbards fitted to them, and belts and baldricks tooled of the rarest leathers. She found this amusing. What brought the high price was what she had created. Swords that would not rust, would not break, would not lose their edges. Swords with a set spell for each season. For spring, the spell of calm. For summer, the spell of warding. For fall, the spell of healing. And for winter, the spell that attracted luck. Valuable spells, all of them. Daughter to a fighter, and once a fighter herself, though she was now a magesmith, she knew the value of being able to keep a cool head under the worst of circumstances. Spring swords generally went to young fighters, given to them by their parents. The value of the spell of warding went without saying. To be able to withstand even some magic was invaluable to, say, a bodyguard. With one of her summer swords, no guard would ever be caught by a spell of deception or of sleep. Wealthy mercenaries generally bought her fall swords, or the noble-born, who did not always trust their healers. And the younger sons of the noble-born invariably chose winter blades, trusting to luck to extract them from anything. The ornamentation meant nothing. Anyone could buy a worthless court sword with a mild steel blade that bore more ornament than one of hers, but her contact had assured her, over and over again,
that no one would believe her blades held power unless they held a Trollope's dower in jewels on their hilts. It seemed fairly silly to her, but then so did the fact that most mages wore outfits that would make a cat laugh. Her forge leathers were good enough for her, and a nice divided wool skirt and linen shirt when she wasn't in the forge. Once every 4 years, she made 11 swords instead of 12, and forged all 4 of the spells into a single blade. Those she never sold, keeping them until one of the sisterhood attracted her eye, proved herself as not only a superb fighter, but an intelligent and moral fighter. Those received the year swords, given in secret, before they departed into the world to earn a living. Never did she tell them what they had received. She simply permitted them to think that it was one of her remarkable, nearly unbreakable, non-rusting blades, with a simple healing charm built in. After all, why allow them to depend on the sword? If any one of them ever guessed, she had yet to hear about it. There was one of those blades waiting beneath the floor of the forge now. She had yet to find someone worthy of it. She would not make another until this one found a home.
"That's what I want," whispered the sword in the back of Elspeth's mind.
The scene changed abruptly. A huge building complex, built entirely of wood, looking much like Quentin's mage school. There were only 2 differences that Elspeth noticed. No town and no stockade around the complex. Only a forest on all 4 sides, with trees towering all about the cleared area containing the buildings. Those buildings looked very old, and there was another difference that she suddenly noticed. Flat roofs. They all had flat roofs and square doorways, with a square knot pattern of some kind carved above them. She was tired. She tired often now, in her old age. A lifetime at the forge had not prevented joints from swelling or bones from beginning to ache, nor could the healers do much to reverse her condition, not while she continued to work. So she tottered out for a rest, now and then, compromising a little. She didn't work as much anymore, and the healers did their best. While she rested, she watched the youngsters at their practice with a critical eye. There wasn't a single one she would have been willing to give a sword to. Not one. In fact, the only girl she felt worthy of the blade wasn't a fighter at all, but was an apprentice mage, now working out with the rest of the young mages in the same warm-up exercises the would-be fighters used. All mages in the sisterhood worked out on a regular basis. It kept them from getting flabby and soft, as mages were all too prone to do, or becoming thin as a reed from using their own internal energies too often. She watched that particular girl with a measuring eye, wondering if she was simply seeing what she wanted to see. After all, she had started out a fighter, not a mage. Why shouldn't there be someone else able to master both disciplines? Someone like her own apprentice, Vina, to be precise. Vina certainly was the only one who seemed worthy to carry the earblade. This was something that had never occurred in all the years she'd been forging the swords. She wasn't quite certain what to do about it. She watched the girls stretching and bending in their brown linen trews and tunics, hair all neatly bound in knots and braids, and pondered the problem. The sisterhood was a peculiar group, part temple, part militia, part mage school. Any female was welcome here, provided she was prepared to work and learn some useful life task at the same time. Worship was given to the twins, 2 sets of gods and goddesses, Caranal and Dina, Caranel and Dara, healer, crafter, fighter, and hunter. Shirkers were summarily shown the door, and women who had achieved self-sufficiency were encouraged to make their way in the outside world, although they could, of course, remain with the sisterhood and contribute some or all of their income or skills to the upkeep of the enclave. All this information flashed into Elspeth's mind in an eye blink, as if she had always known it. Those girls with mage talent were taught the use of it. Those who wished to follow the way of the blade learned all the skills to make them crack mercenaries. Those who learned neither supported the group by learning and practicing a craft, or in healing, either herb and knife healing, or healing with their gifts. Or, very rarely, taking their place among the few true priests of the twins at the temple within the sisterhood complex.
the creations of the crafters in that third group, and those mages who chose to remain with the Enclave, supported it through sales and hire-outs. The sisters were a diverse group, and that diversity had been allowed for. Only one requirement was absolute. While she was with the sisterhood, a woman must remain celibate. That had never been a problem for the woman whose soul now resided in the blade called Need. Interesting, though, in all her studies, Elspeth had never come across anything about the twins or the sisterhood of sword and spell. Not that she had covered the lore of every land in the world, but the library in Haven was a good one. There had been information there on many obscure cults. On the other hand, there had been nothing in any of those books about the Cold Ones, and Elspeth had pretty direct experience of their existence. She'd never found any man whose attractions outweighed the fascination of combining magecraft with smithery. Of course, she thought humorously, the kind of man attracted to a woman with a face like a horse and biceps rivaling his own was generally not the sort she wanted to waste any time on. She sighed and returned to her forge. The scene changed again, this time to a roadway running through thick forest from a horseback vantage point. The trees were enormous, much larger than any Elspeth had ever seen before, so large that 5 or 6 men could scarcely have circled the trunks with their arms. Of course, she had never seen the Pelagirus forest. Stories picked up from mercs along the way, assuming those weren't exaggerated, had hinted of something like this. The fair was no longer exciting, merely tiring. She was glad to be going home. But suddenly, amid the ever-present pine scent, a whiff of acrid smoke drifted to her nose, causing instant alarm. There shouldn't have been any fires burning with enough smoke to be scented out here. Campfires were not permitted, and none of the fires of the sisterhood produced much smoke. A cold fear filled her. She spurred her old horse, which shuffled into a startled canter, rolling its eyes when it scented the smoke. The closer she went, the thicker the smoke became. She rode into the clearing, holding the sisterhood, to face a scene of carnage. Elspeth was all too familiar with scenes of carnage, but this was the equal of anything she'd seen during the conflicts with Hardorn. Bodies, systematically looted bodies, lay everywhere, not all of them female, none of them alive. The buildings were smoking ruins, burned to blackened skeletons. Shock made her numb. Disbelief froze her in her saddle. Under it all, the single question, why? The sisterhood wasn't wealthy, everyone knew that, and while no one lives without making a few rivals or enemies, there were none that she knew of that would have wanted to destroy them so completely. They held no secrets, not even the making of the mage blades was a secret. Anyone could do it who was both smith and mage, and willing to spend 1 month per spell on a single sword. Why had this happened? And as importantly, who had done it? That was when Vina came running, weeping, out of the forest, face smudged with ash and smoke, tear-streaked, clothing and hair full of pine needles and bark. Again the scene changed, to the forge she had seen before, but this time there was little in the way of walls or ceiling left, and again knowledge flooded her. Vina had been out in the forest when the attack occurred. She had managed to scale one of the smaller trees and hide among the branches to observe. Now they both knew the answer to her questions. Who was the wizard Heshane, a mage lord who had never before shown any notice of the sisterhood? Vina had described the badges on shields and livery of the large, well-armed force that had invaded the peaceful enclave, and she had recognized Heshane's device. Why? His men had systematically sought out and killed every fighter, every craftswoman, every fighter apprentice. There had been mages with them who had eliminated every adult mage. Then they had surrounded and captured every apprentice mage, except Vina. They fired the buildings to drive anyone hiding into the open, and had eliminated any that were not young and mage-talented. The entire proceedings had taken place in an atmosphere of cold efficiency. There were no excesses, other than slaughter, not even rape.
and that had struck Vina as eerily like the dispassionate extermination of vermin. Afterward, though, the bodies of both sides had been stripped of everything useful and anything that might identify them. Still, there had been no rapine, no physical abuse of the apprentices. They had been tied at the wrists and hobbled at the ankles, herded into carts, and taken away. Vina had stayed in a tree for a full night, waiting for the attackers to return. Then she had climbed down to wander dazedly through the ruins. Vina had no idea why the wizard had done this, but the kidnapping of the apprentices told her all she needed to know. He had taken them to use, to augment his own powers, to seduce, subvert, or otherwise bend the girls to his will. They had to be rescued, not only for their own sakes and that of the sisterhood, but because if he succeeded, his power would be magnified, considerably, quite enough to make him a major factor in the world. A man who sought to increase his power in such a fashion must not be permitted to succeed in his attempt. He had to be stopped. Right. He had to be stopped. By an old, crippled woman and a half-trained girl. This was a task that would require a fighter of the highest skills, and a mage the equal of Hesheng. A healthy mage, one who could ride and climb and run away if she had to. But there was a way. If Vina, a young and healthy girl, could be endowed with all her skills, she might well be able to pull off that rescue. One person could frequently achieve things that an army could not. One person, with all the abilities of both a mage of some strength, perhaps even the superior of Hesheng, and a fighter trained by the very best, would have advantages no group could boast. That was their only hope. So she had sent Vina out, ostensibly to hunt for herbs she needed. In actuality, it was to get her out of the way. She was about to attempt something she had only seen done once, and that had not been with one of her bespelled swords. She took the hidden sword, the one with the spells of all four seasons sealed to it, out of its hiding place under the floor of the forge. She heated the forge, placed it in the fire while she wrought one last spell, half magic, and half a desperate prayer to the twins. Then, when the blade was white hot, with fire and magic, she wedged it into a clamp on the side of the forge, point outward, and ran her body onto it. Pain seared her with a white-hot agony so great it quickly stopped being pain and became something else. Then it stopped being even that, and what Elspeth felt in memory was worse than pain, though totally unfamiliar. It was not a sensation like anything Elspeth had ever experienced. It was a sense of wrenching dislocation, disorientation. Then, nothing at all. Literally. No sight, sound, sense of any kind. If she hadn't had some feeling that this was all just a memory she was re-experiencing, she'd have panicked. And still, if she had any choice at all, she never, ever wanted to encounter anything like this again. It was the most truly, profoundly horrifying experience she had ever had. A touch, connection, feelings, sensations flooded back, all of them so sharp-edged and clear they seemed half raw. Grief. Someone was weeping. Vina. It was Vina's senses she was sharing. The spell had worked. She was now one with the sword, with all of her abilities as mage and as fighter, and everything she had ever learned intact. Experimentally, she exerted a bit of control, moving Vina's hand as if it had been her own. The girl plucked at her tunic, and it felt to her as if it was her own hand she was controlling. Good. Not only was her knowledge intact, but her ability to use it. She need only have the girl release control of her body, and an untrained girl would be a master swordsman. Vina sobbed helplessly. Uncontrollably. After the first rush of elation, it occurred to her that she had probably better tell the child she wasn't dead. Or not exactly, anyway. The sword released its hold on them, and Elspeth sat and shook for a long time. It was a small comfort that she recovered from the experience before Skiff did. She had never been so intimately one with someone's thoughts before, especially not someone who had shared an experience like Need's death and rebirth. She had never encountered anyone whose thoughts and memories were quite so unhuman. As intense as those memories were, they had felt old, sounded odd, as if she was listening to someone with a voice roughened by years of breathing forge smoke, and they contained a feeling of difference and distance, as if the emotions Need had felt were so distant, or so foreign, that Elspeth couldn't quite grasp them. Perhaps that made a certain amount of sense. There was no way of knowing quite how old Need was. She had gotten the distinct impression that Need herself did not know. She had spent many, many lifetimes in the heart of the sword, imprisoned, though it was by her own will. That was bound to leave its mark on someone. To make her, in time, something other than human? It was possible. Nevertheless, it was a long time before she was willing to open her mind to the blade again, and to do so required more courage than she had ever mustered up before. "I wish you wouldn't do that," the sword said, peevishly, the moment she re-established contact. "What?" she replied, startled. "Close me out like that? I thought I made it clear. I can only see through your eyes, hear through your ears. When you close me out, I'm deaf and blind." Oh. She shivered with a recollection of that shared moment of pain, disorientation, and then nothing. What would it be like for Need in those times when she was not in contact with her wielder? Best not to think about it. "Can you always do that?" she asked instead. "As long as you aren't closed out, I mean." Skiff showed some signs of coming out of his stunned state. He shook his head and looked at her, with a bit more sense in his expression, as if he had begun to follow the conversation. "Once I soulbound, the way I did with Fina, and most of my other wielders,